Joining us today to chat about the upcoming release, Macho Man, The Untamed, Unbelievable Life of Randy Savage. He is author John Finkel, who joins us here at Post Wrestling to chat about this upcoming release on Randy Savage. John, thanks so much for taking some time to chat with us.
Thank you for having me, John. I'm pumped.
So tell me a little bit about just the process for you in terms of we're about a week out from the book release at this point. What is kind of the last week like for you, where all the work is done? You're probably knee deep in media interviews and promoting the book. What's this week like for you with the countdown coming down to the last couple of days?
Yeah, it's to borrow a phrase from our guy here, it's wall to wall madness right now. It is just at 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning, all the way through talking Macho Man. And it's the best. You know, when you write a book like this, it's, you know, a couple, you know, 100,000, 115,000 words, and you start 2 years ago, and, you know, 99% of it is you in a computer at night at a coffee shop working around your kids' games and coaching and life and family and all this stuff. And to finally be able to talk about it, it's amazing. I have a friend of mine who writes, who's an author also, and he always says, like, when you start a book, you're basically writing into the future. So everything you're writing, you're just projecting 2 years out or more when people will actually read it. So now that we're finally here, I'm grateful for guys like you to want to talk about it.
How do you sort of contextualize the history of Randy Savage? Like, when you started out on 2 years ago, obviously this is a very, very well-revered figure during an extremely popular time in wrestling's history. But I think there's still so much out there that has not been chronicled by whether it be the WWE or outside projects. Like, what kind of hole did you feel you were filling with this book?
Yeah, I thought there was the massive hole, number one, thankfully, because this is my 10th book, and this is what I've been calling sort of one of my bucket list biographies. It's one of the three or four people I've always wanted to do a biography of. And, you know, I wanted to make sure that I had the chops to do it before. It's not, you don't pitch like Macho Man biography as your first book, right? Like, there's so much there. He's such an icon. He's such a you know, an A-lister for almost a decade and a half. And so for me, the process is really like you get into the research. And for me with Macho Man, it actually starts with Angelo, right? You know, when you start a biography, all the best biographies I've ever read, you know, before I even became a writer, as I was in high school and college, they always set you up for why this person was who they became and who surrounded them and had a nice influence on them. And so in this case in particular, because Randy was a wrestler, it matters a ton that his father was a fairly well-known professional wrestler throughout the 50s.
I was really blown away by especially like the early years. I think everyone knows like Randy's, you know, desire to make it in baseball and having a cup of coffee in several farm systems, but especially going into like the high school days. I mean, it was remarkable just to see the drive that this guy had, that there was X amount of talent that he was going to make up for with just an obsession to make it into baseball. And I found that to be some of the most fascinating stuff in the book.
Thank you. It was the most fascinating stuff to research. And so, you know, when you, like I said, you begin with Angelo and his wrestling. So in my mind, before you really dive in, you know, you put together a skeleton of the story of, it's basically, and what I've learned having written all these books, you basically throw it out, right? It's like, here's what I know before I've talked to anybody or really done more than the cursory, you know, here's the big bullet points that everybody already knows. What ends up happening every single time ever in a book, it's the same, like, is that Mike Tyson phrase of, you know, everybody plans for a fight until they get punched in the mouth, right? Like, you can plan a biography all you want until you do your first three interviews. And then all of a sudden, you know, every interview, if you're good at what you do, you say, who else should I talk to? Who can I not miss for this book? And all of a sudden you have a list of seven people you've never heard of who are also telling stories that you've never heard of. And in this particular case, all those roads led back to Angelo, to Downers Grove, then to Randy, you know, a young guy named Randy Poffo, who was beyond obsessed with baseball. There was nothing else in his life. There was no social life. It was all baseball all the time. And even if you had told him, you know, as a 17 or 18 year old, you're going to be a wrestler, he would have said, I don't want to be a wrestler. I don't care about wrestling. My dad did that. I'm going to be a Major League Baseball player.
I think that it's a part of his life just to try and get into his head of someone that just dedicated like night and day towards baseball and gets to this end. Like, it's one thing when, you know, circumstances are like an injury that stops. But as you outline in the book, like, this was someone that just at a certain level realized, I'm very talented, I'm just not at that next level. And to be able to take that and state that this whole dream is not going to happen, and I have to transfer my talents elsewhere, that's a massive shift for any individual of just coming to that realization that I've put in all this work and I'm just not at that level to make it as a professional.
Totally. It's a story. I found it a couple of different times throughout the book that his story is really a story of reinvention. And, you know, with wrestling, we're used to babyface the heels and we're used to turns and we're used to new storylines that may take us somewhere where we never thought we would go, or, you know, even just kind of completely doing a 180 on a character. But this was his life. So, and anyone listening, whatever your diehard dream was, imagine getting within inches, literally, you know, for a football analogy, getting on the 4 foot line, you know, you're right there and it just doesn't happen. You know, almost all the minor league players and coaches that I talked to were just like, if there was a major league baseball of hustle and heart and almost their talent, he's in it. He had everything you needed. He had all the mental makeup. He was at all the, you know, all the credentials as a high school player, all the credentials. He made a couple minor league all-star teams. He just didn't have that it tool. He wasn't the fast enough to be there. He could hit, but not hit great. He could hit for power, but not enough power. He could run the base pass, but not fast enough to be a guy who stole bases, you know? And so he built his body. He built his mind around becoming a baseball player. And so it's extremely important to his story and to his future success for readers to understand when they read this book, what it took out of him to not make it. I mean, it wasn't like he spent the whole time with 1 foot in wrestling and 1 foot in baseball. He was 100% into baseball. And when it ended, whatever we all dream of being a pro athlete or whatever it is that we're going to be, but maybe most of us don't pursue it. We go into something else. Or we just realize, you know, hey, I wanted to play for the Celtics growing up. I'm not 6'6" and I have a terrible jump shot. It's not going to happen. I realized that in sixth grade or something. This guy had it. He was on the path. And so when it ended, it wasn't like he turned, you know, it wasn't like he got his cut slip from baseball and said, oh, well, no problem. Like, Dad, I'm ready to go. He tore up the locker room. He exploded. He got home and destroyed all his bats and said, I am never touching a baseball bat ever again. And like the next day, just somehow, which I think is one of the most remarkable mental tricks that he was able to pull, and it speaks to his tenacity, he truly closed that door. And never once thought, all right, maybe next year I'll try again, or let me go play in the Dominican, or let me go play in the Grapefruit League somewhere. He just went all in on baseball, on wrestling after that.
Yeah, and it does feel at some times as though when you're juxtaposing the baseball dreams and then to professional wrestling, almost like this becomes two separate individuals. Was that somewhat of your experience of the people you spoke to that – it seemed a lot of the people in his baseball life were just amazed at who this guy went on to become.
It's incredible. It's my favorite part of the research is when you talk to people, and it doesn't matter who I'm doing a book on, but in Randy in particular, when, you know, there's people who everybody can see it coming, right? So like, you know, I did a book on Charlie Ward, who won the Heisman Trophy and played basketball for this. He was an extraordinary high school athlete. Everybody could see he was going to be an extraordinary college athlete. And it was like, okay, what is he going to do? Football or, you know, or basketball? And so when he became a pro, everyone who'd seen him play in high school was like, obviously, this guy is the most talented person in every field he ever stepped foot on. With Randy, this was the case for baseball. Everybody assumed he was going to play Major League Baseball. All his teammates in high school, all the guys he talked to, you know, once he got to the minors, it was a little different because that's where to hit, you know, to use his phrase, the cream of the crop really was there in baseball and he wasn't at that level. But to your point, when he decided to move into wrestling, there was just no thought of like, okay, I'm gonna try this for a little bit and try something else for a little bit, you know. And all of the people who I interviewed there was no Randy Poffo talking to them about, well, if this doesn't work out, I'm gonna do what my dad does. You know, he talked wrestling, he knew some moves, so he did have some fun in the locker room with some of the guys. But the funniest part about it is almost everyone who you talk to, especially from his high school days, and I talked to almost his whole team, they're like, I don't have any fun stories about this guy. He didn't talk. He walked around high school with a baseball bat. He had a weighted baseball. He'd sit in the back of the class and do like tricep exercises to strengthen his arm. He had a batting cage on the side of his house. Like he wasn't the macho man. He was a quiet person. And even his minor league teammates, they're always like, yeah, people, whenever, you know, when he passed away, especially, or something comes up and somebody wants to talk to some of these guys, they're like, he was just a guy. One of the talent scouts for the Cardinals was like, he was just another young goof trying to play baseball. Like, there's no stories there. And so it isn't until you get to the ICW days and beyond when he creates, to what your point, a brand new person. And a lot of the high school friends that he had, and even some of the guys he met in the minors who he remained close with, they refer to the Macho Man as the other guy, almost like Bruce Banner and the Incredible Hulk. Like, well, we never knew about that he had the other guy inside. We only saw Randy. But then Randy Savage and Macho Man became such an incredible thing that some of the guys some of the friends he had in high school who he, you know, like we all do, just completely lost touch with. This is way before social media. So, you know, you leave high school and you may never hear from or see another person ever again. They didn't know for years after hearing of maybe the Macho Man, because their kids got into wrestling, that it was actually their teammate, Randy Poffo.
I've heard you state of just the importance of having Lanny Poffo on board as well for this. Of course, Lanny Poffo passed away while you're in the midst of writing all this. If you can just tell us what that unlocked for you in terms of Lanny and, you know, this being like the kind of the key to so many different avenues of Randy Savage, and was also kind of the unofficial family historian too.
Yeah, that what you just said is what he was. I think he was the official family historian, and also probably one of the most official like encyclopedias of the 70s, 80s wrestling universe. Having, you know, he was very, you know, Lanny is an extremely smart guy. He was well read. He understand what his family's place was, what his father's place was in wrestling, and he certainly understood what his brother meant, even maybe more so than Randy himself did to the larger picture of wrestling. And so when I started putting the proposal together for this book and talking to publishers about it, I had a lot of interest, but I just could not see myself writing this book without at least having access to Lanny and interviewing him a few times to go over things. I just, you know, the number one reason was from a credibility standpoint. I knew I just couldn't, I wouldn't have written it. I told my agent, I told some of the publishers, like, I am all in on this book. I will do everything and it'll be the greatest book I've ever written. But if I don't talk to Lanny, I'm not going to do it, because there'll be so many issues. I'm close to my brother. So that's kind of one of the other things of like, when you're talking about growing up, especially with Macho having passed away, like, what was your house like? What was it like going into an arena with your dad when you were 6, 7, 8, what was grade school like? You can interview a lot of people, but if you have a brother at the time alive, you're just never going to get the inside stuff that you're going to get from somebody else. And so it took me well over a year to get in touch with him. Funny enough, a guy I'd interviewed for my book before this, it was called 1996, a biography. It was a biography of the 1996 sports year. That was the year everybody listening knows that Stone Cold made his debut in the WWE as, you know, the ringmaster, and the year that The Rock showed up as Rocky Maivia. So pre 96, there was no Rock or Stone Cold in WWE. And after that, we all know what happened. And I interviewed this guy, JP Zarka of Pro Wrestling Stories, who's become my friend since then. And he had years before that, you know, a podcast with Lanny, and he knew him fairly well, and he did some interviews for his site. And so he offered to put us in touch, and he vouched for me. And even with that, Lanny was not a recluse. He was public when he wanted to be public and away when he wanted to be away. And he lived in Ecuador half the year. And so it took about a year to finally connect. And when we connected, we had a nice conversation. He grilled me with a bunch of Macho questions, asked if I was related to Howard Finkel. And we had a couple of fun exchanges there. I'm not, by the way, I told him my dad's Harvey Finkel, so the same initials. And anyone who knows Lanny would know he would appreciate little thing. He was a big wordplay type guy, so he appreciated that. And then we spoke for hours after that. You know, he was like, well, hit me. How many questions do you have? And I was like, 100. You know, I was like, a lot. Luckily, I'd already done my research. You know, I'd already been deep into it, so I wasn't just like blank canvas. Like, what was he like? It was real specific. Like, when you were in Toledo, when you were here, when you went to Hawaii for baseball, what the day Macho didn't get drafted, what was the house like? Like, real, real things. And he was awesome. And so I kept a running list of questions to keep asking him. And then, unfortunately, you know, whenever it was, about a year ago, I had got the text from JP telling me he had passed away. And like I say in the intro to the book, I mean, I had a list of what I called Lanny cues right next to on my desk. And that was it. So this really is sort of, at least from an interview of the family standpoint, the torchbearer, the last time I think he talked at length at what we, you know, about the family and about Randy.
For Randy in the book, so when he goes to WCW, he's about 42 years old at that time. And it's interesting. It seemed like Vince McMahon had this idea that, at least at that time, like, once he hit 40, it was like, that was like the number that just suddenly it was.
Yeah.
He no longer saw Randy Savage as being an in-ring participant at this point, had put him onto the broadcast table. Did you feel like that had done a lot on Randy, just in terms of his own sort of I don't even want to call it like an insecurity, but definitely there was friction there of believing that he still had a lot left to give in ring. But here in this company, like that number 40, it just seemed like that did not compute with what Vince McMahon was promoting.
Yeah, to borrow our pal Cody Rhodes' line, like he didn't get to finish his story the way he would have liked to with WWF, I think, or now WWE. He, from what Lanny had said, he needed a break after the WrestleMania and SummerSlam and the wedding and all those. I mean, he had the wildest part about all this when you read it. You know, I followed him. I was the perfect age to follow him as a kid. You know, I was 8, 9, 10 through WrestleMania 3, 4, 5, like. I believed everything happening. You know, I believed the retirement match with him and Ultimate Warrior. Like, I believed that one of them was never going to wrestle again. I believed that, you know, Ricky Steamboat's larynx was shattered. Like, I was the age, and thankfully my parents didn't ruin it or anything. Like, I believed all of it. So looking back as an adult now, and I'm married and kids and all that, when you realize that as he's doing the whole, you know, summer wedding and SummerSlam and all these things, he's actually behind the scenes. Like, his personal life is a disaster. Him and Elizabeth have separated. He's lost his in real life and in the ring. Hulk Hogan was they were still super close. He had already been kind of getting a little bit of a stiff arm from Vince about what to do after all this. And so he took the break and went to the booth, which I think was probably good for a little while. He was beat up mentally, physically, needed some time off. And then it was like, he had this plan that I guess Lanny tells in the book, where he wanted to finish his career with one big story arc and one, which is amazing, his testament, one big final loss. You know, that's the beauty of Randy. He was at the end of the day, like his pinnacle was doing something legendary for the fans. He never, obviously he wanted to get the belt and he got the belt and all that. Once that had happened, his dream finish was in a loss to a big storyline and a loss to what would have been Shawn Michaels. And he had planned it all out. I mean, I won't ruin it. I want people to read the story in the book, but like Lanny told me at a 3 a.m. phone call, the two of them mapped out like what I believe would be an incredible storyline and finish for Macho's time in WWF back then, but it didn't happen. And I think, Lanny said that Randy had an FU list a mile long. And I think on top of that list for most of his post-wrestling, post-WWE career was probably Vince.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I was curious, you know, going back in your own research and seeing what like it exists out there with Randy Savage. Like, this was someone extremely guarded. I mean, this was at a time where, you know, especially during the 80s and 90s, wrestlers were not doing a ton of out of character interviews. But even beyond that, I mean, Randy, after WCW, he like does the very brief TNA stint, and then he's out of the public spotlight. Yeah. What was the challenge in trying to just find him in his own words when, you know, he's been passed away for 13 years and this was not a guy that was out doing all these shoot interviews and being interviewed?
Yeah, fortunately, and it's kind of what my original background is newspapers were a big deal for a very long time. And so a lot of these guys, especially in the territory days when he was with the ICW and then eventually when he was, squaring off with Jerry Lawler, these guys would do, the AM paper and evening paper interviews. Now, again, you really have to be careful with in character, out of character. But fortunately with Macho, there was, and I ran through some of these stories with Lanny. There was very little. He just, the beauty of him was he didn't turn it off. And so therefore, just about everything he said was not so much a work, but like 60% true, so you could take it with a grain of salt. But I was very careful quoting things where it was from him or, I would try to say from Randy Savage or from Macho Man or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. But newspapers were invaluable. I mean, all these Midwest towns that they spent all these years in, and even all the way through his WWE, WWF days, when he would announce, when something would be announced, when he first got the belt, he became the face of WWF for that year. He was doing 6, 7, 8, 9 radio interviews, TV interviews, newspaper interviews a day. So I actually was able to find a lot of interviews where he was talking about, you know, what it meant to him, what he was doing, how he was staying in shape, how he was handling traveling. Whenever he went to a town, he would do these local papers. So you'd find, you know, the Staten Island Gazette, and, you know, when he, a story about him buying property there. And then, so it was really piecing it together through local newspaper articles. And then whenever I would see someone in these articles, obviously, it's not hard to find now if someone's alive, if they're on social media, if they're on Facebook. Facebook groups are great. There are a lot of fan pages dedicated to Randy. And I found a lot of his old ICW, you know, wrestlers on there who stayed in touch with him throughout his life. And then he was very involved in charity throughout the very end of his life. So yeah, anyone listening who knows, he used to speak for the George Steinbrenner, the Children's Hospital in Tampa every year. I got in charge with the guy at the Yankees who was in charge of that and spoke to people involved in that. You know, I got extras on Spider-Man. So when he appeared, there was a nice ecosystem of people around him who had experienced the Randy Savage, you know, life and who he was and what he was like. And so between all of that, there really wasn't too many just dark gaps in terms of conversations, at least in what I termed thought was what people would want to read. You know, that there's, you have, when you write these books, you have to be aware of pace and narrative and time. And so part of it is, you know, it's all journalism. And then there's like 50% of it is like nostalgia and storytelling. And so you don't want to get bogged down on stuff. There's things that I researched towards the end that I left out, mainly because when you read the story as a whole, you're like, all right, I'm on page 270. This is, we all know what happens. We want to get to what happens and how, you know, how his life finished and how, what his legacy was, you know, like a movie director. Sometimes you cut some of your favorite stories because they just bog down the flow of the book.
3 years ago, A&E did the biography on Randy Savage and Lanny on Pro Wrestling Stories. He had written kind of his rebuttal to it. He called 75% of the A&E biography episode on Randy Savage was great. 20% was lousy and 5% was horrible. In relation, like, there are, you know, definitely some dark accusations from Stephanie Ballard's. How did you approach that aspect? And was there any decision to try and reach out to Stephanie Ballard's? And what did you think about the A&E biography?
I, you know, it's like everything else now, like, it's for engagement, right? Viewership. Like, you could go through every wrestler who existed all the way till now and spend time on the things that are salacious that the people who are maybe non-wrestling fans might like, oh, that's interesting. I'm going to say it. And I told it to, when I went through it and I've talked about it, like, as we did the editing, like, that stuff just doesn't, I don't find it that fast. It's 95% of the Randy Savage fans who would read this book don't even know who she is or who that last part, you know, I was trying to figure this out with a buddy of mine. And it's like, probably 70 to 75% of the people who would read this book and be interested in it lost touch with Macho after he left WWF. I mean, I know WCW was huge, but the age, people aged out. That's what happens in wrestling. You go to high school, you get into sports, your own life, your girls, or whatever you're doing. And you kind of circle back into it maybe when you have a little more time. Like, and so most of the people, you know, a lot of people aged out, whatever percentage who followed him in WCW. And I was one of those, you know, that's more of a harder core Macho. And then if you followed him all the way into the mid late 90s, all the way through the end of the, you know, Team Madness and all that, you're talking about like a very tiny percentage who would be fascinated by that part. So I wanted to make sure I was writing it where it was for the majority, right? Like people, like, where it's like the nostalgia trip hits, all the things you'd want to know and not know. And, you know, those interviews, I saw the documentaries and I read the interviews about the documentaries. I didn't want to be like the credibility is questionable on some of the stories, just from the timeline of things and some of the things that, you know, Lanny and I talked about. And that I didn't want the book to be the, you know, because realistically it's only going to be 6-7 pages just kind of addressing this. And So I wanted to talk about, like, here's when he sort of exited stage left from the larger wrestling world. And then, you know, here's the legacy that he left as he was done, when he got remarried, when he did Spider-Man, when he did movies, voiceovers, when he did Slim Jim. The things that I think would be interesting. So I kind of have a gut feeling when I do books on what would be fascinating to readers and what might not be. And, you know, those things may be 100% true or 100% false. But in the end of the day, since the documentary existed, go watch that if you're fascinated by the last, you know, that I think was Lanny's biggest part, was, you know, 50% of the time was spent on 1% of his career. Right. And it's just, I don't know, it didn't interest me that much to spend that much time writing about it.
Did Lanny give any insight into sort of where Randy's head was at towards those latter stages in WCW, where, it really does feel like it's, you know, someone that is coming to grips with like his age, his own, you know, placement within the industry. And then into the, like the latter years where he takes a definitive leap away from the spotlight and you're pretty much not hearing from Randy Savage.
I think I titled the last title, last chapter was called Serenity, right? Where he had seemed to be coming to peace with everything. And Lanny told me like a great sort of, he told me like a great microcosm for how he knew this was Randy was a lot of things, but he was, as you can tell from his, all his outfits, he was a pretty vain guy. He liked how he looked. He wanted to look a certain way. And toward, you know, he dyed his hair. He did the sun tanning everywhere. He burned his skin around his beard, all the things to stay looking. He wanted to look, even in the Team Madness time, which, you know, anyone who had just, if you just click that on, all of a sudden, you know, it's like, I called it like a dark macho phase. It's the ponytail. I mean, he didn't look, there was no joy there. And I didn't think so. And, you know, whenever I would come across that during that time frame, it was like, where's Randy? Like, I know you're making a turn and everybody's the attitude era, but like, you're 50. Yeah. Like, come on. And so, Randy said, all of a sudden, you know, he stopped dyeing his hair and, you know, let the beard go white and kind of just came to peace with his receding hairline and started wearing his hair back. And, you know, then, you know, he famously ran into Hogan and they kind of reconciled. And, you know, there was the olive branch with the WWE and the video games and the action figures. And he was slowly reappearing. I talked to a guy who lived in Tampa who asked him to come speak. A friend of his knew Randy from the gym that he worked out at back then. And he asked him to come speak to his football team. And, you know, this is, you know, 52-year-old or whatever, you know, Randy older goes in, like fires him up. Not only that, like donates money to the weight room. Like he was a guy, you know, and then named the weight room after his father. These are the stories that nobody knows that I found really spoke to who he was, which is what I wanted to spend the time on towards the latter, you know, 10% of the book. And so he was coming to peace with who he was. There's a universe where I firmly believe if he lives, you know, doesn't have his heart attack while he's driving and all that. There is a universe where he has a grand second act with wrestling, where he is that beloved legend that all, you know, that storyline that we all want, where he just shows up and the pop is insane and he does his whole thing and probably comes out at WrestleMania's wearing his gear and christening the next version of him. I mean, it would have been really cool to see him, you know, work with an LA Knight or one of these guys, not wrestling, obviously, but just, you know, interact with this newer generation. I think he would have really dug it.
The last thing I'll touch on is, you know, his passing in 2011. I think anyone that has followed wrestling knows that when someone of that stature passes on, it's going to be big. But it was very eye-opening to me just to see there were so many fans during that era that now all of a sudden they're in these positions working at various websites, television stations. And you just saw like this went so far beyond just the wrestling bubble of how big of a story his passing was in 2011. How do you recall your reaction seeing that news, which of course caught everybody off
Yeah.
guard?
You know, he was my guy. Like when you follow wrestling or sports, both, you get your people, right? Yes, you know, I'm eight, you know, it's impossible to not have been a Hulk Hogan. I mean, Hulk Hogan was the great, like everything back then, right? I mean, there was a reason he headlined every WrestleMania. Like every kid loved Hogan. Anyone who looks back and says they didn't is lying. He was just this big, giant, blonde superhero. And with the ear thing and, you know, brother, like everyone loved him. But we all had our sort of secondary guy who was our favorite, even though everybody liked Hogan. And Macho was my guy. And so when you grow up with someone with his personality and with his charisma, quoting, you know, I can't even count millions of times the just saying things that he would say and the cream of the crop and cup of coffee in the big time and the things that have moved into the public lexicon. And then, you know, Slim Jim really took him to the mainstream. Yeah. He's the main reason why the reason why your mom actually knows Macho Man is because of the Slim Jim ads. And maybe then you remember that he was a wrestler. His staying power, what they did for each other, the brand and Macho Man, has really helped cement his legacy. And when you find out he passed away, when I found out, it was terrible because the internet was going on. Social media was, you know, in full swing. So everybody was tweeting and texting and all these kind of things and making posts about him. And thankfully YouTube was around. So his videos, you know, everybody who was a wrestling fan in the 80s and 90s maybe three times a year would go on a 2-hour YouTube wormhole, just all your matches and all the stuff. And that was the beauty of writing this book with my son, who's now 11 and was 9 when I started. Like, again, peak wrestling years, is all in on this current crop of guys. And we rewatched the entire Macho canon from you know, the old Saturday Night Main Events, the Piper's Pit, everything all the way through. And so, you know, when he passed away, it's like a piece of your childhood passes away. It's, you're not going to connect there. You're not going to have that moment. And he didn't get that big homecoming of like back with, we never got him and Hogan in the ring as 65-year-olds. You know what I mean? Like commemorating some of the big matches they had, or, you know, coming on one of the shows at an anniversary of one of his, you know, one of his major matches. And unfortunately, a lot of the guys, you know, Wall Warrior and some of these other guys are all passed away too. And Liz is gone. And it's tough. It's really, really tough. So yeah, I'd say the way to put it is like the big nostalgia piece of your childhood is gone when someone like that passes away. And that really is what I wanted to fulfill with the book, is to give everybody that smile on their face of what it was like to take everybody on that ride of what the Macho Man, what madness was really like at the time.
Well, the book is out next Tuesday. It is Macho Man, The Untamed, Unbelievable Life of Randy Savage. I think people are going to be really impressed with just the level of research that you went in. I think, you know, stuff that was, especially the early, the childhood stuff and the baseball stuff that I just found so instructive in terms of getting into the head and the mindset of this guy who was, I mean, there's driven, and then there's another level that you really tap into that kind of informs the rest of this guy's career. So congratulations on the book, John. And I want to thank you so much for us and having a extended chat with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it. I love talking about him, and I love hearing that when people learn more about someone they already kind of really understood and cared about, that means the world to me. So thank you for reading, and thank you for having me on.